This is from Freddie DeBoer's Substack. Freddie DeBoer is a cultural critic and writer and academic. This was posted today. It's called Palestinian Painted Plates and the Nothing Party. This is just an excerpt from the beginning. And there's a visual aspect to this, but we'll link to it so you can look at it. There's a story from last year about Israel-Palestine, sort of, that you probably haven't heard of. And that's strange. It's exactly the kind of culture war red meat that people love to click on. The problem is that the people who would do the culture worrying, the heterodox, the, quote, dissidents, the, quote, intellectual dark web, they sat this one out. Because one orthodoxy they'll never break is the one that says you don't side with the enemy, which is, of course, the only orthodoxy that's really worth breaking. Last February, before the current conflict, The Guardian reported that a London hospital had taken down a controversial art display made up of the painted plates you see above. You may think there doesn't seem to be anything remotely confrontational about these plates, but I can't tell you why they're so wicked by looking at them. You become offended only when you know they were painted by Palestinian children. Children from Gaza. Some of the patients at the hospital read the little plaque and learned that they were made by children from Gaza and felt marginalized and othered enough to throw their weight around and get the artwork taken down. Look again. Do you see the Palestinian flag? I guess you can sort of see a little piece of one in the upper left-hand corner, but then again, the central image of that plate is a literal olive branch, a plea for peace. Do you see Free Palestine anywhere? Do you see women in hijab and dupattas? Muslim-ass people doing Muslim-ass things, but that's it. The plates were just decorative objects, painted by children, a half a world away. And yet the mere existence of these utterly anodyne plates decorated by children compelled a pro-Israel organization to force the hospital to take them down, because they supposedly made Jewish patients feel, quote, vulnerable, harassed, and victimized. Have you ever heard anything that better fits with the anti-woke worldview than that scenario, other than the fact that the action broke against Palestinians? That's Ben Shapiro's wet dream, vulnerable, harassed, and victimized by plates. Only too bad it's the WOGs who have painted them. It's like a parody of the liberal snowflake culture, this scenario. If this exact same thing happened, but with the ethnic valiances reversed so that the Palestinians got Israeli artwork taken down by a hospital, which they could never achieve, Joe Rogan would have Jamie pulling up that thing to mock it every month, every day for a month. The Reddit stupid ID poll would crowdfund and send a correspondent to investigate. Helen Lewis would write a snide story for The Atlantic about it. John Chait would sweat into his keyboard for hours as he fulminated about it. 6 million turf substacks would find a way to turn this into a complaint about how some people with penises wear dresses. John McWhorter would be inspired to write a column wondering aloud what Thomas Sowell would make of today's world. Thomas Sowell is still alive. Brett Weinstein would say that the controversy was proof that fluoride makes you gay. The Free Press would start a four-part podcast series about it, hosted by a horse girl. The entire apparatus of anti-wokedom would kick into high gear. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Dunra Ramadan about a group she was with that disrupted the governor's State of the State address. That burgeoning local movement is for a permanent ceasefire in Palestine, an end to U.S. support for occupation, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing. My guest tonight is part of that group, and I want to talk about her background, how she got involved with it, and just a little bit about what's going on, because as things move along, things escalate, and we need to talk about it, and we need to support what's happening. Full disclosure, as I've said before, I've supported this group. I've participated in actions with this group, and so you can take that any way that you want as we talk. Maryam Rahmani, how are you?
I'm doing okay, all things considered. Thank you. How are you, Ram?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad that you could join.
Me too. Thank you.
Yeah, the first question I wanted to ask you is a question I ask not everyone, but almost everyone who comes in who's involved in activism, organizing, civil disobedience, any kind of thing like that. It's just about your background, you know, where you grew up, what it was like, and what about it might have sort of influenced you or motivated you to put your body on the line.
My story, I've lived a lot of places in the US. I was born in Orlando, Florida. I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I've lived in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and I've lived in near Baltimore, Maryland, and now I'm in Newark, Delaware. So I've lived in quite a few places. My background, I'm half Iranian, and the other half is a mix of Mexican and Native American and several other things, but those are the majority. Having that experience, my dad came straight from Tehran, Iran, to attend high school in the US. So, having those identities, and especially Florida was where I experienced a lot of just the things that sort of fuel me now in my activism and wanting to raise awareness and help people who maybe have gone through similar or worse things that I have experienced. Just having those identities, especially. Okay, so I was in elementary school in 2001, and I'd already experienced a lot of hate and just racism before. But 2001, me and my sister, my younger sister, the level of hate that we experienced, and just even as first and second graders, I think about that a lot even now, because a lot of the themes that I am experiencing now, and I know a lot of people are experiencing now, it's reminding me of what I experienced back in elementary school, being called a terrorist, or for no reason, or even my sister in first grade after 2001, she was put on a no-fly list, and it took a very long time to get her off that no-fly list, simply because of her name. And for being Mexican, my mom, she doesn't speak Spanish as much anymore, but growing up, she would speak Spanish sometimes, or when, especially when they saw people, when they saw me with my grandfather, my papa, who looks very Mexican. The comments we would get, we were chased into a bathroom one time and told to go back where we were from. So it's just, those are the things that have kind of shaped my passion for doing what I can to stop that, or at least raise awareness that this is happening and people need to step out of their comfort zone and do what they can to stop it. So, relating to current day events with the ongoing events in Gaza, we're seeing I think we're seeing a turning point now, in that more people are pushing for awareness, more people are demanding awareness and being loud. For awareness, Rob included, as he mentioned, we've gone to several events together, several actions together. So that's sort of what fueled me to get involved. I also studied my degree in college was society ethics and human behavior. So it was very much related to these themes and activism and education around activism and social justice and movements. So just my whole life, it's sort of been shaping and leading towards like shaping who I am. And now this is the most I've been involved in actions before with other movements, but this is the most I've ever been involved. And I think it's because even though I'm not Palestinian, I'm part of, well, one, you don't have to be Palestinian to care about the Palestinian cause. You just have to be a human and have a heart. But personally, I identify as Muslim. I was raised Muslim. I'm Middle Eastern. And with the Native American side of me, I identify with, the Native populations being suppressed and not able to get their voices out. So it's very, very important to me. I also have many friends and loved ones over in Gaza right now that I'm keeping in contact with. So just all of those things have led to this being the most active I've ever been, with protesting and direct actions.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about some of the stories that you're getting firsthand from Palestinians on the ground in Gaza. But before I do that, I kind of just want to ask like a question. A friend of mine, or sort of a mutual friend, I guess, pulled me into some stuff over a month ago that turned into what's happening. And I should say, you know, it sort of started as a protest just outside senators' homes. You know, the state of the state was disrupted, and there's been some other actions more recently where there's been some escalation. We'll talk about that. But I was just pulled in sort of on the side, and I noticed, like, there was definitely people organizing it, but it wasn't coming from a centralized place. It's people, and more and more people have been added on since. Yeah, I think that's a really incredible dynamic of this group. I also think what's an incredible dynamic, and maybe you can speak to this as well, is it's mostly women. Men are helping out, so, I'm helping out, but the fact of the matter is that the leaders, the organizers, the people who are doing scheduling, the people who are doing logistics, the people who are doing, finding legal support and all of that, it's women. And it's funny because Carl and I and other organizers in the state talk about, some of the difficulties of organizing, and sometimes there's gender sort of problems, powerful people take over, that type of thing. This has been an organic sort of spread out movement that's women driven, and I think it's very, very it's very poignant and very inspirational. I think maybe you could speak to that a little bit too.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. I think it's inspirational too. I think we're a bunch of really powerful people, and then as you said, it is largely women led, so a lot of powerful women. For me personally, I living in Newark, before I was introduced to this group a couple months ago, I was looking for actions to get involved with, and I was driving to Philly, I was driving to DC, I was driving to Maryland, which I still am because I want to be involved as much as I can, but I couldn't find, it was so hard to find actions in Delaware, as I'm sure you were aware. And then I was introduced to this group through a friend in Maryland, actually. They were looking to help raise awareness in Delaware also. And that's how I was actually introduced to this group. And I live in Delaware, so it was perfect. And you're right. It's a newer group. It's been a couple months now, but it's a newer group and it's very organic. And I think the fact that so many people, it's growing, and that we allow everyone to sort of voice their opinions, and that is how we sort of shape actions that we do. After every action, we have really meaningful debrief calls where we talk about the actions, what we could have done better, what we should do next time, and just planning and logistics overall. And I think that has really allowed us to continue the sustained efforts, like having the meeting at disruptions at the senator's houses as often as we do, or planning the state of the state on such short notice. I think that just the way that we communicate, it's really led to that and allows that. And I think also the fact that we are the women that I speak with most in this group, we all are we bring our own characteristics. I think we're all pretty outspoken, but in different ways. And we all have different experiences in life, and we all have different skills that we bring to the table. We all have different educations, backgrounds, and just all different backgrounds. And when you combine those things, I think it's just what's allowed the group to really grow in combination with all the backgrounds of everyone that has joined the group since in our outreach efforts. So, I'm excited to see what happens. We're still growing. We get new members every week, and I'm excited to see where it takes us.
Yeah, it's. I can tell you, as being somebody sort of on the inside of it, it's very inspiring. I also want to point out, and people probably understand this that are listening, but there's going to be times where we're going to speak in sort of like opaque terms. We're not going to talk about, how many or what or when or where. And I think everybody can kind of understand why we're doing that. So if you feel like we're being a little close to the vest, obviously that's why. We're still out there with, it's still me. I'm not anonymous. I'm out there, and everybody has been out there. And I haven't gotten a lot of information yet, but I know that a few people were arrested, I guess, earlier this week at Senator Carper's home. Number one, were you there? And can you give us sort of your sort of report from there?
Yeah, I was there. We were there for to break iftar with Senator Carper. We were standing across the street from his house on the public, like, wooded area. We had set up a projector, and it wasn't that many of us. I think there was seven total, six to eight people. And we were there to break iftar. We welcomed him to come out and talk with us. We've tried all the bureaucratic channels of reaching him. We've tried emails. We've tried phone calls. We've even left letters for him. And none of it's worked. So we went to invite him to come out and talk with us to break our fast for Ramadan, for iftar. And we aren't sure if he's aware, really, based on his policies, of what it looks like on the ground in Gaza and what the people from Gaza are sharing with the world. So on the projector, we were sharing testimonies and videos, and mostly videos, reels from Instagram from people on the ground in Gaza, journalists, doctors. One of my best friends is in Gaza, Dr. Anas, and we played a lot of his videos too, just to show Senator Carper what he may or may not be aware of. I hope he's not aware based on his policies and what he's advocating for, but I'm assuming he is aware. And anyway, but so that's what we were doing. The police weren't there when we first showed up. They showed up pretty quickly, though. Senator Carper was home, or at least some of his family was home. We're assuming he was home. The lights were on when we got there, and then once we started, the lights were all quickly shut off in his house. And soon after, I think within about 30 minutes, the first police car showed up, and I think there was a total, at the peak, I think there was five or six police cars. Five or six. And again, there was only seven of us. So, and they stayed there the whole time. I'm sorry if you hear my dog in the background, by the way.
That's perfectly fine.
Thank you. But they stayed there the whole time. And originally, me and Dunya, we were using megaphones, and the first policeman that came over, he just told us we couldn't use megaphones and we couldn't use our drum. And we were respectful of that. He said that the music was fine, the speaker was fine, and that he could hear our voices loud and clear, and that was fine. We could all chant together. So we were respectful of that. We put the megaphones, the bullhorns down, and the person attending that had the wooden drum set that down too, and we didn't touch them for the rest of the action. We only used our voices and the speaker that we were told was fine. And we were there for maybe an hour and 45 minutes more, 2 hours more. It was about like 9 o'clock, 9:15 p.m. when we started to pack up. And we were taking the projector, not the projector, the screen that the projector projected onto. We were taking that down. It was literally being disassembled. We weren't chanting anymore. We were being quiet. That was it. And the police started to walk over in a group. And I forget his name. But one of the police just started saying, "You were told not to use a drum." And you were told not to use a drum. He said it twice, I think. And we recorded the whole thing. Luckily, someone was recording the entire thing. But we were all confused because, of course, as I mentioned, the drum was set down almost at the beginning of our action. When we were first told we couldn't use it, it was on the ground and it hadn't been touched. So we stated the drum hasn't been used. It's on the ground. We're literally packing up. We're trying to leave. And then the policeman walked over to another member of our crew who was manning the projector and put his hands on the projector and started to take it away from her, like towards himself, and said, "I am seizing this drum." And we were very confused because, of course, it was a projector, not a drum. And we tried to tell him, "This is not a drum. It's a projector. We're confused. We've listened to everything we've been told." And he then told the person who was holding the projector and trying to pack it up, because she kept her hands on it, and she was confused. She said, "Sir, this is not a drum. It's a projector, and I'm packing it up. We're leaving." And then he said, "You do not want to be hit with another resisting arrest charge," which at that point, she hadn't even been placed under arrest. We were it was so confusing. And she even made a comment. She said, "Another? I've not been arrested." And I'm laughing from stress. It was a very stressful event.
No, I can tell you I've been in situations like this in my career, my life, whatever you want to say. And I know it's extremely stressful. I completely understand. I will say this just to tell you my position on it. You got their attention. That's when things like this escalate, and the way you guys handled it is so beautiful anyway, because you're prepared for it, because you guys talk about it, and like you're frustrating the system and they don't know what to do. And so, maybe it was somebody who told you not to drum a week ago, or maybe it was that they're just confused and they have no idea how to handle this. I mean, you said something very interesting at the beginning, basically saying like stuff like this doesn't happen in Delaware very, very often. We did have a lot of big actions during sort of a in the aftermath of George Floyd. There was some very big actions. Some dicey stuff went down. There was people arrested actually outside of Dover by the state police, and a journalist was arrested and detained, not charged, but detained. So there's been some of that right around George Floyd, but of course we have a history of, at least in Wilmington, of having an occupation, a federal occupation for a period of time. And I think between that and where we are politically, it kind of put a damper on this kind of stuff. But what you're seeing is just flailing around. The authorities do not know sort of what to do with this. And that's sort of what you're running into. So I just wanted to point that out. But yeah, go ahead. So you get this line, like you're going to get hit with another charge. And she's like, I didn't know I got hit with one charge already. And they're kind of having a back and forth with this projector.
So they were having the back and forth with the projector. First, I wanted to add a comment that the first policeman made when he told us not to use the horns that was related to what you said. He actually he made a comment that he hadn't attended, like he hadn't seen one of our events before, but he'd heard a lot about them. So we're obviously, bothering the police. They're aware. He made that comment to us. So you're very right. I think you hit it spot on. So back to the story. So the police had his hands on the projector, and so did our teammate. And he made that comment, and then she responded, I'm not even arrested. And then he looked to the police, a man standing behind her, and said, handcuff her, please place her under arrest. And she was not read her rights. They just put her hand the handcuffs on her. And then she had her phone was on the little table that the projector was on. Like she wasn't holding it. And I went to grab it, and they said, no, that is her property. You leave it. That's for her to deal with, not you. They wouldn't let us touch anything that they assumed was hers. Like they wanted to take all of it. And they put her in handcuffs, and they started walking her back to the car. And we were all very confused. And the policeman who asked her to be placed under arrest, he told the other police around, I think at that point there was like four or five standing around. He told them to get the plastic cuffs, meaning zip ties, which we
The
saw
old
them.
zip tie, the old zip tie
Yeah,
routine.
zip tie, the old zip tie, which we saw them holding later. They were like holding them and like threateningly. It was a lot. But he told them to get them just in case, which he said it loud enough for all of us to hear. And the whole time he just kept repeating, you were told that you couldn't drum, and this is a drum. And we were getting frustrated at that point, and we were still being respectful. We didn't want anything to escalate, even more, because we could tell they were just being unfair at that point. So, but one teammate was more frustrated, or more visibly frustrated, and came over because they started to also take the speaker, the big speaker that was playing the sound, which was obviously not a drum. It's a big speaker. And we were specifically told the speaker and the projector were fine earlier by the first cop that came and interacted with us. So one teammate who was more visibly frustrated came over and was asking, this is not a drum. This is our property. Why are you taking it? And the one who demanded the arrest, he just kept saying, you were told you couldn't drum, and this is a drum. And the one our teammate said, you were hearing the sound of bombs. You were hearing bombs, not drums. And then the police man who ordered the arrest made a comment. He said, no, I was sitting in my car, and I heard one of you say to Senator Carper, you said, we know you hear these drums, and I had my windows down, and I heard you drumming. This is a drum. It was a speaker. It was a speaker. So he was just saying whatever he could.
That's now, and it is. That's probably what it was. They heard sort of bombs dropping in the background. And just you have them all. You have them tied in knots. I think that's pretty clear.
I
Anyway, go
think
ahead.
so. No, not at all. I think you're right. So they put her under arrest and put her in the car, and they weren't willing at first to give us badge numbers. They were just ignoring us, standing in silence when we were asking for badge numbers. There was one police officer who had been standing there. He was one of the five or six that were standing there, but he hadn't really said anything. He did say to the one teammate that was more visibly frustrated, we thought he was sympathetic to our cause because he kept looking at us and just, we could tell he was sympathetic just from his face. And he kept telling her, like, please stop, like, don't make it worse, please stop. But then something shifted at some point, and he just started to look very angry, and then he wouldn't talk to us. And he was one of the ones that wouldn't give us his badge number for a long time. And when he started to finally walk away, we said, you have to give us your badge number, give us your badge number. And then he said it with like a tone as he was walking away with his back to us. And then we were asking for the one who asked for the arrest to be made. We asked for his badge number too. And he just kept saying he didn't have a badge number because he was the not chief, that's the wrong word.
Supervisor.
The supervisor. Yeah. And he said, supervisors don't have badges. I'm the supervisor. And so he gave us his name, and we confirmed with someone else. Another police woman walked over and said, yes, he doesn't have a badge number. He's a supervisor. So we got his name and confirmed that that was correct. He wasn't withholding anything from us. And they told us where they would be taking our friend. And the address, which at first they didn't want to do. They kept saying, she's an adult, she's an adult. And we're like, well, she's part of our team. She's part of our team. Tell us where she's going. So they did. And we went there. Our group, we all went together. All of us went because we support everyone in our group as a group. So we all went to the police station, and after packing up all of our belongings, of course. And we were there for a little over 2 hours total, I think.
It's not too bad. It could have gotten worse. Could have been
No,
worse.
definitely. It wasn't too bad. I mean, for a phony arrest, it's still, but yeah, it definitely could have been much worse. But when we first got there, we arrived in two separate cars, and the first group got there a few minutes earlier than my group did. So one of us went and knocked and asked, where in the process they were. And again, we were told, she's an adult. She can fend for herself. She's an adult. You can wait outside. So we waited outside. And again, like I said, it was a little over 2 hours. And then we saw her because it's glass windows and we were standing on the sidewalk. So we saw our teammate being released. And she came out and met us. It was by that point, I think 11:30 to midnight-ish. And they weren't charged. They were given a citation, so they weren't actually charged with anything. And the citation said, it mentioned the drums, but it also mentioned the speakers that we were told were okay, which were not mentioned at the time of arrest at all. So it was very clear they were just putting something on paper. She was, they were given a court date, which, they were given a court date, and but there was no charge, no fee, no nothing. It was just literally a piece of paper and a court date. So,
ROR, released on your own recognizance, and you get a ticket.
That's yes.
And to be clear, because again, we're being a little bit opaque, this is one person. There was one arrest.
One arrest, just one, correct.
Okay, because there was some rumors that it was more than one, but.
No, that we were threatened for more than one. When we were asking for clarification on why they kept saying drums when the drum was, and we even pointed to it. We said we've been recording this entire action. Do you want to watch it? The drum has been on the ground since we were told not to use it. That's when we were threatened to all be arrested, and he said to go get the plastic cuffs. But no, it was only one arrest.
Okay. Yeah, the other issue that I had heard that could be a little trickier because I don't know whether it's like a violation or an actual like crime you have to deal with is the resisting. Was resisting on the violation, do you know, or was it sort of noise and other things?
It was not that, from what I remember, I looked at it very quickly. It was not mentioned on there. It was just a noise. So the drums were mentioned, the speakers were mentioned. I don't think the resisting was mentioned at all from my
Okay.
memory.
Well, I do know that there's an attorney who will be helping out here and representing. I do know that. I know that person, and I'm very glad that they're on it because, yeah, and I think here's my sort of assessment, and I'll, you know, this is a little bit of speculation. I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth, so if anybody's listening to this, this is all REV saying it. I think they're getting tired. They don't deal with this a lot. And not only are they getting tired of dealing with it, you're annoying, like, the princes of the city. You know, there's certain princes that live in the city, Chris Coons, Mike Brzezicki, Tom Carper. Actually, our governor lives in the city, Carney. So there are certain princes, you know, and if not only are you sort of drawing attention, but you're annoying, like, you're annoying our gentry, you know. And so the funny thing you said was like, yeah, we heard about this. Yeah, because they're trying to come up with, like, okay, how hard do we push just to get them to stop? Like, will this arrest do it? Or next time we'll do something else, we'll overwhelm them. And I suspect that has a lot to do with the escalation on their end. But I'll ask you this, and you can say as much or as little as you want, but as someone who is sort of tracking these conversations through the sort of the different networks that are going, I don't see a lot of people that are discouraged. I was having a conversation with another attorney yesterday about sort of the situation and that I was going to get more information. And I just said, they have not been deterred. So this isn't going to do it. That's at once very, I'm very happy about that. And it's also, you know, things that need to be thought about as you move forward, because, you know, it could potentially get more serious. But yes, can you speak on, you know, how the spirit is with the group and hearing you guys standing there when somebody's coming out from being arrested for civil disobedience, it just gives me, like, I've been arrested and been detained a few times. And when you're with a group, like, everybody cheers when you come out and they're giving you hugs. And it's like, I don't know. What they don't understand is that's all part of this action. That's all part of the solidarity, camaraderie of this. So, you know, whatever you throw at me and I take, I'm just going to get, you know, more emboldened by it if it's something that you really believe. But anyway, that's my spiel. I wonder, as you reflect on it and you think about moving forward and doing more organizing, sort of how everybody's feeling within the group.
Yeah, no, everyone echoes exactly what you just said. So it's like I said earlier, after every action, we have they're always very helpful, and we get so many wonderful new ideas, not just for actions, but for safety and planning purposes, logistics, from our debrief sessions. So that is still in the works for this most recent action where the arrest occurred. And we've already mentioned that what you said, like, we need to plan, because now it's one arrest has happened, we anticipate escalation. So we definitely need to be mindful of that and plan for it so that our actions are still effective and everything is as safe as possible. But no, we're not deterred. In fact, when we were waiting for our teammate to be released, we were standing outside the police station. It was freezing. It was very cold, and we were all standing outside, and we had, like, I brought dates and, like, a loaf of barberry bread and water for iftar, but we hadn't eaten it because we were busy outside Senator's house, of course. But we were all hungry because none of us had dinner, so we were standing outside the police station on the sidewalk, and I just opened up the container of dates and this barberry bread and gave everyone bottles of water, and we were all standing there just talking about the action and talking about how it's not going to deter us. And we were all just eating together, and not everyone was fasting, but I broke my fast, the people who were fasting broke their fast, and everyone was just eating together. And you're right, it was part of the action itself. So no, we're definitely not deterred. We are continuing to plan more actions. So no, I would say it only sort of fuels want for more action, even, because we know we're getting under their skin. We know that the senator was home. We know that we were bothering him, and he should be bothered. So it only fuels it.
Yeah. Well, first thing is, and with a small group, you had sort of bigger, you have bigger situation to sort of deal with as that happened. But, you know, I live very near the Wilmington police station. So when stuff like that, you know, if people need a place to crash because they don't know how long people are going to be there, if people need a place to eat, if you need, I could probably come up with cash on hand if necessary, all that stuff. Please reach out for real. I know when it's only five or six or seven people, it's like you got to get there. You got to make sure you know where the person is. You got to make sure that you got eyes on them. That, you know, it was the first time this happened, so I can completely understand. But yeah, there are resources that we can rally in Wilmington quickly, and then we could probably rally resources pretty much anywhere quickly. But if you are in a situation where you need more time, more resources or support, please call me.
Thank you. I appreciate that. One thing I forgot to mention, you mentioned earlier that we prepare for things like this. And even though it hadn't happened before, and now that it has happened, as you said, and I said, we know how to better prepare for future events. I'm very glad that we sort of anticipated this happening. We knew that, you know, going for iftar, it was going to be getting dark. Things usually escalate more when it's dark. So we planned for it, and we have at previous events too, or actions too. We had, you know, liaisons and jail support. Like, we have all that. We've been very effective in that aspect of our planning, I think. So thank you for offering just another resource to add to that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I know that going back to sort of dealing with the structural, with Babylon, as we say. Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. I'm reading a book right now because I'm going to be interviewing an academic next month about police training. Like, it's called Before the Badge. It's basically about how they acclimate people into this insular system where they basically look down on everybody. You're either weak and need to be protected or you're a bad guy. And so they just look down on everyone. And it tells the story about how they do their selection process and how they do their training modules to continue to reinforce these ideas. So they're on their inside bubble, and they're looking down on people just saying, we got to clean up the riffraff. These people, you know, they're not following the rules. You know, they're making our lives miserable. And so they're not going to understand the gravity of it. They're trained not to care. So, yeah, I mean, we're going to see that sort of rev up. But what is important is that very thing. That agitation highlights really how awful the situation is. And I think that's the most important part of it. And I think I agree with what you said earlier. We seem to be reaching a point where cracks are starting to open up. I mentioned it after the State of the Union disruption. Excuse me, the State of the State disruption. That was unprecedented. That's never, no one around here, and a lot of people have been around here a long time, have ever seen anything like that. And now we have, you know, an arrest at a civil disobedience action. So things are going. There's this escalation is going to be noticed, and I think that's. The fact that you guys have sort of digested that and are working with that and understand that, I think is really exciting and motivating to me, because I've when I first met you guys, the person who introduced me actually works a little bit with Carl, and I met you guys the first time and we went out, and I remember reaching back and telling them, hey, thanks for the heads up. You know, for doing this and reaching out. I said, I feel like I've been waiting my whole life for a group like this to sort of materialize, because you can't really force it. As much as Carl and my friend Kirsten and me and everybody who does this work, Cheyenne, as much as you try to do everything you can to make it happen, ultimately it kind of has to manifest. You can be like a farmer and you know, prepare the ground for it and make sure that the conditions are right where people will join it as it goes. But really, there's something about it where it has to manifest. And it happened here, and it's extremely exciting. You know, that part of it, and again, you sort of alluded to it a little bit. There were some people from out of state meeting people in state. Other people are joining. But again, it's not, it's directed by a group of people who are sort of managing all the different things that need to be managed, but it's not centralized at all, I don't feel.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of us are, like I said, I've been involved in actions before for different, like the Muslim ban and different things before, but this is the most active I've ever been. And that's the same for many people in this group. And for some, maybe they weren't even active before. It's their first time. So just, I think that speaks to one, the power of the strength of our group that we're able to learn together. We're all learning together. We're not well seasoned. Well, now some of the people in the group are. We're gaining more experienced people in the group. But to start, none of us were very well seasoned, I would say. And but we're learning very quickly, and we want to learn because we want to have the most effective actions possible too. I think it really speaks to how dire, just like you said, how dire the situation is in Gaza and with Palestine now. And that people who have not participated in actions before or been in any way done anything like this before themselves, they're seeking us out. They are walking up to us when we are outside the senators' houses. They are walking up to us outside the State of the State address. A few people walked up to us and asked and said, like literally crying. There were people crying, walking up to us saying, we have never done anything before, but I want to help. I need to do something. And it just really speaks to, like you said, the cracks that are, thank goodness, starting to show. And it, as terrible as the situation is, still ongoing, it gives me hope that things are starting to change. And that's really needed now to continue in this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to make one sort of last statement before we wrap up. I had read the book Zone of Interest when it came out 15 years ago. And actually, my wife read it as well. We don't share a lot of, we have some of the same tastes, but I think mine are more like towards nonfiction, and Susan will read anything. But we both read it, both really enjoyed it. And so we were very interested to see how the film would come out. And I did really enjoy the film. It's very different than the book. It's much starker and sort of scaled down and gray. But there's the lesson, and people don't seem to be learning it, is that, like, there are people facilitating these crimes and this massacre, and maybe they don't feel like they are, or maybe they're ignoring sort of their direct hand in it, or maybe they're very good at sort of, like, dissembling. But the fact of the matter is that Chris Coons, who lives around the corner from me, and Tom Carper, who lives right up the street, are facilitating this slaughter. Because we, as Americans, are facilitating the slaughter. It would not happen without our guns, without our rockets, without our Apache helicopters, without our warplanes. And so that's why this is happening, and it's going to continue to happen. So that's that part. Like, this is not, as you said, and that's the thing that's really sort of inspiring, is that I see it growing in the background too. And so, you know, something's going to have to give at this point. And I think that's why people who think the way we do are a little bit excited, because I've never gotten, at least from the, I mean, a couple of years ago, Carl and I had a conversation in here, and I said, what is it going to take, bro? Like, this is crazy. Like, I can't talk about this, or I'm an anti-Semite. Like, what is going on here? And Carl, even off mic, was just like, I don't know. I don't know. And of course, the whole thing is just fucking tragic. But the big tragedy of this is that what had to happen to move the needle, to start to build momentum, to stop this, is just horror on a level that, you know, can't even really imagine. And that's kind of what I wanted to give you the opportunity to do before we end, is I know you've been in close contact with friends, with doctors, with just, you know, citizens of Gaza. If there's anything you can share or sort of talk about that sort of, you know, is poignant to you or important, you think, I would love to hear some of those stories.
Yeah, of course. I'm in contact with quite a few, many people actually. Even before, so I started working with a nonprofit organization. So I'm in contact with many of the aid distributors on the ground in Gaza actually now for that. But even before that, I was in contact with just myself personally, people on the ground in Gaza reaching out to me. And that includes doctors, well-known journalists, a young girl who I've become very, very close with who lives in Rafah now. A doctor at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah, who has told me, and we've told each other, we're each other's best friends now. So just the stories, not even just the stories, there's stories, of course, that they tell me from the nights before, but usually they don't even like to say words about what's happening. They like to talk about other things, like with the doctor at Al-Aqsa Hospital, before things really escalated, he liked to talk about just life, and he wanted me to send him pictures of beautiful things around, like scenery, and we talked about tennis. The young girl who calls me her older sister, and I call her my little sister now in Rafa, I talked to her whole family. She speaks English the most fluently because unfortunately I'm not fluent in Arabic, but so I talk to her the most, but we talk about her dreams of being a doctor, a surgeon, actually, a surgeon. And but the clips that they send me audio clips, and you know, they don't have reliable internet all the time, so sometimes I don't hear from them. For example, the girl who calls me her older sister in Rafah, which Rafah is being violently attacked right now, I'm getting those clips again, in abundance, that I wish she didn't have to hear in person, and I wish I didn't have to know she's hearing and then get the audio for it hours or a day later. On the night of the Super Bowl, she sent me, and I didn't get it till the next morning because her internet, but she sent me so many clips of the violent bombing of Rafah during the Super Bowl, and the messages, the text messages she sent me, it's heartbreaking, saying that she thought she was going to die, that she didn't think her family was going to survive. She told me, like, her last message to me was that she never wanted me to forget how much she loved me and that she wished she could meet me now. And it's just, it's very, very hard. And as hard as it is for me to get these messages, I cannot even imagine how hard it is for her to exist in that scenario and send those messages. So, and that's only one person. I have many friends there. So it's been very difficult to know what they're going through and feel like, as much as I know that I'm trying to do, it feels like it's not enough because they're still living this. They're still living in this hell every day. And it's, you know, we had the UN pass the month of Ramadan, the ceasefire temporary halt resolution. It's only gotten worse since that happened. So I have friends in Rafah, in Deir al-Balah at Al-Aqsa, in Deir al-Balah in other parts, in Nusra camp, in the north of Gaza. I have friends there near Al-Shifa. That is absolutely catastrophic. Yeah, I have friends all over Gaza, and it's terrible no matter where the stories are coming from. So,
yeah. I want to say that, well, first of all, I understand how you feel like, you know, it's not enough because it's not getting anywhere. But this is really inspiring, wonderful work that you all are doing. Well, it's tough. It's something that I've always had in the front of my mind. I've told people before that when I came up, you know, and started to be sort of like politically aware and have a little bit of international solidarity, and I started to form sort of political opinions. It was when apartheid in South Africa was starting to crack, and there was movements about boycotts. There were, you know, the apartheid government was being marginalized and isolated. And I see that happening now. You know, I find it very rich and very ironic that the reason that Israel is a state is because the United Nations said so. So, you know, it is a huge step for at least to be. It's the same with the International Criminal, the International Court of Justice. They seem impotent. You know, they seem like unenforceable sort of folly. But these are the first very important steps in isolating and in pointing this out, gathering evidence, and isolating these apartheid murderous lunatics. And it's heart-wrenching to know that there are friends of yours in these camps right now that don't know whether they're going to ever make it out. And there's and you know, the slow march towards justice is too slow for them. But from my cushy seat here and our cushy seat here in the United States, we're not going to stop.
Never.
Never, ever. And, you know, I just, you know, I want to try to give everybody hope. It's the time, Ramadan Kareem, everybody. And it's just, this is a tough one. You know, for me, that flag back there, it was the first thing when we moved the studio here 4 years ago. I told Carl, I was like, we're moving the studio, the flag's putting it on up in the studio. Because it's just been a thing that I've always knew was one of the biggest crimes of my lifetime. And, you know, I'm so inspired and so happy you guys are organizing the way you are. So, Mariam Rahmani, thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And if you don't mind, I just wanted to end on one more thing, just because you said you wanted to end on inspiration. The actions that everyone is doing, no matter, I voiced how I feel. I know I'm not the only one feeling that way. It is so important to remember that the people in Gaza and the West Bank across Palestine, I have friends in other parts of Palestine too. They are seeing these actions. The number of messages I get from my friends, especially in Gaza, but the West Bank, in different areas of Palestine, just saying how thankful they are that we are speaking up for them. I can't count them. So if anyone needs to hear that what you're doing matters, if you're feeling how I often feel, just think of that. You are making a difference to someone in Gaza. They see it. They see it and they appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's international solidarity, folks. You got to have it. None of this program that we're talking about, I know people sort of like, I don't get it. I've had a couple of those conversations recently with older blockhead type people, boomers and stuff. And they don't want to get it. And I'm just like, look, if you're on board with the program, the socialist program, a working class, working families program, then you have international solidarity with working families and the oppressed. That's it. It's just that simple. And so I'm glad that it's becoming such a movement that it's being recognized, and it's a point of hope for the people that are going through it, really going through it. So, Mariam, thank you so much again for doing this. And I have a feeling this is not the last time we'll be speaking with each other.
I'm sure it's not. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Of course. And everyone, you know where to hit us up. Patreon, that's The Highlands Bunker. We're on Twitter at The Highlands Bunker. You know what to do. You know, start making sure that you're on board with this kind of stuff, because the tide's turning and we can push it hard now. So that's what it is. It's international solidarity because left is best.